Today's Taisho will be on case 32 in the Umen Quan, the Mumon Quan. Case 32, a non-Buddhist philosopher questions the Buddha. A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, "I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words." The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, "The world honored one, with his great compassion, has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way." And after making bows, he took his leave. Then Ananda asked the Buddha, "What did he realize to admire you so much?" The world-honored one replied, "A fine horse runs even at the shadow of the whip." Mumon's comment. Ananda was the Buddha's disciple, but his understanding was not equal to that of the non-Buddhist. I want to ask you, what difference is there between the Buddha's disciple and the non-Buddhist? Mumon's verse, "On the edge of a sword, over the ridge of an iceberg, with no steps, no ladders, climbing the cliffs without hands." I want to thank everybody for coming here today on this beautiful fall day to practice the way. I'm very grateful to everybody here, and I think we had some wonderful sitting this morning. It's just as the sun was coming up, it was a beautiful day out there. A little bit of fall in the air, and on one side of the sky it was still black, and on the other side it was blue and sort of like rose colored. So the sun is rising up and the day is beginning, and we all came here at various times to practice this beautiful path of Zen. And I want to thank you all for coming today and practicing it together. Today's Taisho is entitled "A Non-Buddhist Philosopher Questions the Buddha." Now, I have recently been reading, I've been reading a couple books lately, among the others that I've been reading, and this book was entitled "The End of Faith." It's by a man named Harris. And Mr. Harris is a really brilliant guy. And he is a neuroscientist. And he has written a book in which he really attacks basically Judeo-Christian religious beliefs. And his book was published by Norton, I believe. And Norton is a small press that usually puts out books that aren't terrifically successful, but some people buy them, you know. And a lot of English literature is published by Norton. When I was undergraduate in the English department, we always used the Norton Anthology of English Literature. That's the introductory literature class. And I think probably people still use the Norton Anthology of English Literature. So the Norton Company puts out these books that are sort of like, you know they're going to sell, but they're not going to sell a lot of books. And Norton sort of has the market of certain kinds of literature books cornered. So they pretty much know that there's going to be so many English majors every year and they're going to buy so many copies of the Norton Reader and some of their other literary books, and they'll survive, right? And they publish a few other little books. And they published this book by Harris, Sam Harris. And it was a runaway hit. And it's called The End of Faith. And Sam Harris just is a brilliant man. And he takes on the Judeo-Christian tradition. And he just goes through the Bible and looks at one absurdity after another. And he pretty much beats the Judeo-Christian tradition to the ground, and then he dances on its dead body. You know. It's one of those things. It's like, enough already, right? But he's very thorough. And then he looks at all the damage that it's caused in the world, and it turns out that all wars were caused by the Judeo-Christian tradition. And all other bad things as well. And at the end of the book, it turns out Mr. Harris, Sam Harris, has been doing a lot of meditation. And he actually has a few good words to say, like one paragraph, actually, at the end for Buddhism. And he says, you know, one of the interesting things about Buddhism is, even though I don't believe a lot of it, is that it really has explored the mind. So when I read this book, I kind of felt like, phew, I dodged a bullet, you know, because this very brilliant man with his scalpel-like intelligence has not taken on Buddhism, you know. So, you know, you could say, well, that's my tradition, and I've escaped, you know, fortunately. And hey, he's even one of us, right? See? The book was tremendously successful, and it was on Amazon.com, you know, top 100 for a year, and it was on the New York Times bestseller list, and so on and so on. And he's quite a pugnacious guy, and he's really smart, and he goes around the country, pretty much like, you know, these audiences come, and some of them just have it in for religion in general, and the Judeo-Christian tradition in particular. And some of them want to argue with him, you know. So, you know, it's like it's like a wrestling match, you know, where in the old days a guy would come to town and he would be a champion wrestler or boxer, you know, and they'd ask anybody in town to come on, take your shot at so-and-so. And, you know, this guy would just, you know, some farmer would come up and, you know, Olaf or something, and the professional boxer would just beat the crap out of him, you know, the wrestler, you know. And these traveling shows would go all over the United States, you know, and it kind of reminds me of that, where it's like, come on, take on this guy, this brilliant man, and it's excruciating to watch these kinds of exchanges, right, because he's so smart, and he can just make mincemeat out of anybody's arguments. And more recently, a philosopher I like very much, actually, a guy named Dennett, has written a book attacking religion in general and the Judeo-Christian tradition in particular. And Dennett also sort of lets Buddhism off the hook. He sort of says, well, I don't even think that's a religion. I'll just leave that alone. And again, you read that and go, shoo, boy, that was a close one, you know. Because Daniel Dennett's really smart. And I actually like him quite a bit. He's a philosopher who works in the Darwinian tradition, and so I've learned a lot from him. And he has a new, and of course, most recently, Mr. Hitchens, Christopher Hitchens, some of you might know his work, has a new book out called God Is Not Great. And Hitchens is like the least nice of the three, you know. Sam Harris is like a very smart man, and Dennett is like a very smart man, and they actually offer like a fair, fair arguments that are very destructive, but they're still fair, you know. But Hitchens is like one of these people, you know. He's like a fighter who hits you below the belt, bites your ear, you know, and basically, you know, when the judge isn't looking, gives you an elbow in the eye or something like that. You know, me? I didn't do anything. You know? So he's like a totally unprincipled person. So he'll win the argument any way he can. If it means, you know, running you down personally, he'll do it in a minute. You know, if it means insinuating that you're an immoral person, no problem. You know, so Hitchens is like the least principled of the three, and probably his book is the most successful of the three, as you might guess. Hitchens has it in for everybody. He even hates the Dalai Lama. You know, he thinks the Dalai Lama is a fascist and all of this stuff. So you think, well, it had to happen. You know, we escaped two out of three. You know. But the other two, you know, we're okay with them because they didn't attack us personally. So, you know, this is sort of the. Let's say that one day the Buddha is, sitting down, and basically in come Harris, Dennett, and Hitchens, and they're going to take on the Buddha, right? Now, you know, you can say, well, he's the Buddha, I'm sure he can handle it, right? But maybe if you really love this path, you might be a little worried for the Buddha. You might feel sorry for the Buddha, you know, because maybe those guys will make mincemeat out of him, you know? And that, then what? See? And this is an interesting issue, you know. I guess many of us have been in a situation where we've had to defend our beliefs, you know. Maybe you haven't been in that kind of a situation, but it's not a pleasant experience, you know. There's something exquisitely painful about having to defend beliefs that are really important to you, to which you've committed some part of your life, you know. It's very, very difficult to deal with. We all have, a lot of people go through a period in their lives, especially when they're, if they're sort of inclined to read a lot of books, when they're about 14 or 15. I think people at 14 or 15 are the smartest they will ever be, you know, maybe 15 or 16, because at that time, I think many humans think they know everything, right? If you have kids, you probably know how annoying that is, right, you know? And I think that a lot of 16-year-olds think they've figured it out totally, and basically they know all the answers, you know? And I can remember my brother was like that, you know, and he would have arguments with my mother about religion. And my mother was a very thoughtful person, actually, and she had sort of vacillated about her religious beliefs. Her mother was very religious, very devout. My grandmother was like a very devout person, and she would she was like a farmer, and she was like a Methodist, basically, you know. And they used to have camp meetings, and camp meetings, it's not like going to camp, you know, you don't get to camp out. Camp meetings means that a preacher is coming to town, and the preacher would you know, people would come and hear the preacher, and they'd have it in a tent. This was like before we had, America was rich, you know, and we had all this extra money to build all these buildings that nobody uses. We used to build, you know, a guy would come to town in a tent, and all the people in town would go, like rural people, would go and hear the preacher, right? And my grandmother was the kind of person who would go and hear the preacher. And she took it very seriously. It was very important to her. My mother was a different generation, and she was more ambivalent, but she tried to have religious beliefs, you know. And I remember my brother just, you know, wrestling with her about this stuff. And so my brother was like a devilishly smart person too, you know. And you know, he would get into these arguments with her, and my mother would wind up making the most absurd claims, you know. So I remember coming downstairs, and they were having some argument about, like, you know, does God watch over all of us? And my mother wanted to say yes, and then, of course, you can always find all these examples of people who get ground to bits by life, or, you know, who are run over by cars. And my mother made a claim. She said, my mother said, well, I still think that, you know, if you're a good person, God watches over you. And I remember my brother had forced my mother to make the claim that she had never known a minister, priest, or rabbi who had been in a car accident. Which is a ridiculous claim, right? And you know, these arguments are so painful to watch, right? Because, you know, almost any belief can be torn to shreds, really, by a clever person. And it's so painful, isn't it? If your own beliefs are on the spot, you know. In college, I had a roommate, Larry Sullivan, that I've talked about, and he was a double threat, you know, because he was both a philosophy major and a psychology major. So not only could he pick your ideas apart, but he could also pick your motives apart, you know. So Larry and I would get into these incredible discussions, you know, about politics or something. And he was very good at dismantling my beliefs, you know. And I can remember just feeling so trapped as he would just sort of, one by one, he'd just, you know, and these were things I really wanted to believe in, you know. So for example, you know, I liked to go hiking out in the woods, and I would you know, feel this deep sense of connection to things, you know. I would just feel this deep sense of connection and being alive and so happy. And so, you know, I'd come back and I would say, you know, we'd live together in this house with one other guy, all these college students. And I'd say something like, you know, I think basically everything is alive. You know, so I think everything is alive. You know, we normally think like of trees as inanimate, but I think trees are alive. And my friend Larry would just start dismantling my argument. You know, he'd say, "What do you mean by alive? You know, define your terms." You know? And I define my terms, but the minute I define my terms, I was doomed, right? Because he was so good, he would just start picking apart what I believed in. As he started picking it apart, I would get more and more nervous and fearful, yeah? Because I knew something had happened to me out there in the woods, and I was trying to put it into words, and he was just slicing and dicing my experience into pieces and sort of discrediting it. And it was so painful, you know. And you see this all the time. You know, it's very interesting. It's very hard sometimes to have any kind of a conversation because people just get so aggressive and frightened by what other people have to say. I have, you know, myself, in my work as an English professor, you know, I've gone to conferences where I've given papers, and without meaning to, I've crossed somebody's belief system, you know, somehow. And I've actually had people stand up and look at me with faces that are like white with anger, you know, really. I mean, it's amazing how angry. These are people who are, you know, quite intelligent and quite, you would think, quite sophisticated. But you can just step on a minefield by saying the wrong thing. Now, I think this is just fascinating, you know. You know, we all try to have a connection to life, I think. My friend Larry Sullivan would go, "What do you mean by connection?" You know? and you start pulling it apart. But I think people want to feel, there are certain things we want, you know, we want to feel alive. I think we want to feel safe. I think love is very important to people. I think compassion and love, we want to be trusted and we want to trust. You know, I think we have these basic human needs. And I think we look around in life for ways to make these possible, you know. And one of the things we often do is grab onto beliefs, you know, or philosophies, you know, systems of thought, ideas. You know, so I got into Zen because I had read some interesting books on Zen by a guy named Alan Watts and another writer named D.T. Suzuki. I'd read these books when I was in college. And then I had the opportunity to actually practice with a real Zen master, you know, and so-called Zen teacher. And it was just a wonderful experience, you know. But I often think, what if I hadn't read those books? And what if I hadn't run into Genki Roshi? You know, when I was in college, I was very interested in religion in general. And I was a double major in English and anthropology, and my area of interest in particular was the anthropology of religion. You know, and I read people like Victor Turner, who was actually at the University of Virginia when I was there, a fascinating person. And all these other people, Clifford Geertz, and people like that. And I just love, fascinated. I read about Mayan religion, Chinese religion, religion in India, Siberian shamanism, fascinating stuff. And I did a paper where I went up to a Trappist monastery in West Virginia, outside of Charlestown, West Virginia. And I tell you, you know, when I went up there, I was so impressed by their way of life that I almost signed up, you know. I actually did ask how to become a Trappist. And I said, what do you have to do to live here, you know? And so they're not allowed to speak, but I talked to somebody after my visit, you know, from the Catholic Church. And the person said, well, are you a Catholic? And I said, no, I'm not, you know. And so that was the end of the conversation. But I was fascinated by that lifestyle. We got to spend the day with the brothers who were living there. And it's very deep, you know, they get up very early. They get up at like 3 a.m. and they do sutra recitation, sort of, you know. They have a chanting and they pray instead of meditating. And they have a very spare collective life. You know, they have no personal property. And they work all day, and they have periods where they pray, and it was very interesting and appealing, you know. So I often think, maybe, you know, if I hadn't run into Genki Roshi and I hadn't read those books, I might be a Trappist monk today, you know. In other words, you know, we're looking for ideas that we can sort of live in, you know, live a certain kind of life. And ideas are like clothing that we put on, you know. And they shelter us, and make it possible for us to live our lives. But there's something a little bit arbitrary about the ideas we actually hold on to, you know. I honestly think that if I hadn't met Genki Roshi, maybe I would have gone back to West Virginia and become a Trappist monk. You know, that's really possible. I have friends of mine who, I grew up with, who, today are like, their religion is like a business, really. And I'm not trying to run them down, you know. I mean, my brother was like that, you know. He was like, supply-side economics, you know, was like his religion. I get up in the morning and I do zazen. My brother got up in the morning and he read the Wall Street Journal. You know, and he could quote the Wall Street Journal the way people quote scripture, you know? He'd say, you know, well, you know, he didn't quote, he'd mention people in the Wall Street Journal. He'd say, well, you know what he says. You know, it's like, you know what, Milton Friedman would say. You know, Milton Friedman, here's what he'd say. You know, and that was like, I was like, that was gospel, you know, to my brother. If Milton Friedman said it, it had to be true. You know? And my brother and I had a very similar upbringing, but you know, it's like he picked a different set of ideas to build his, to clothe himself with, you know. I think there's something very arbitrary about the ideas we pick up in life, you know. And but they shelter us, and they give us protection, and they, you know, and, you know, they're, for that reason, we wind up clinging to them. Very gratefully, and also a little bit desperately, you know. I think that there are people like Jerry Falwell, you know. If Jerry Falwell had grown up in Saudi Arabia, he would have been a Muslim, you know, and he would have been a very devout Muslim. You know, there's no question about it. He grew up in Virginia, and so he became a Baptist. But if life had been a little different, you know, if he'd opened his eyes on another part of the world, he would have had a different, and he might have been a Muslim who looked at Christianity as a terrible thing, you know, as a false religion. As it was, he was a Christian who looked at Islam as a false religion, you know. But there's something, I mean, we need these ideas, right? We need these beliefs. And they're so comforting to us, right? I myself enjoy reading Buddhist literature. You know, I read the sutra, I've read sutras, I like reading books on Zen. It's very comforting. And, you know, the day may come when I pick up a book and somebody just starts tearing Zen to pieces, you know. And you get, you know, it's very painful because, you know, we built our lives inside these values. So, you know, we wind up living this life of, you know, we need these ideas, we need these values, we need these concepts and traditions, and they do have enormous power to reassure us, you know, and it's tremendously painful to lose them, to have them attacked. And yet, you know, there's real problems with these values, no matter what they are, it seems to me. You know, when we look around the world, all over the world, so many of the problems we're facing have to do with our inability to get beyond our values and beliefs, you know. I must say that you know, I was so happy that Al Gore won the Nobel Prize yesterday. And I mean, as somebody who really is concerned about the environment and so on, I was just so happy that he won that prize. And yet, my wife, who is quite a news junkie, you know, was telling me that, she said, you know, Fox News is already attacking Mr. Gore. They're already saying the Nobel Prize is no good. You know. So they said, my wife said, on Fox News, they said, well, Gore's won the Nobel Prize, but so did Yasser Arafat. And, you know, and so the point was it's just a fraud and a scam. And when you look at something like global warming, it's such a serious issue, and when you see people who are, you know, attacking evidence of global, you have to say, well, those people are such bad people, you know, they're such evil people. But I think they're really prisoners of their belief system. Somebody like Sam Harris sort of knows this. You know, he has a point, I think. You know, religious beliefs really do sometimes make people very blind and inflexible, and also violent, right? I mean, he's got a point. Some of the worst violence in history has been caused by religious commitments. You know, people get desperately frightened if their belief systems are threatened, and it is really painful to have somebody tear your beliefs apart. I mean, I've gone to conferences myself where somebody's attacked some writer I like, or I had this experience. I haven't had anybody, you know, come up to me and say Zen is a fraud, blah 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 blah, you know. But when I was just starting out as a teacher, I was teaching like English 101, and in our English 101 program, you could bring in poems and things for students to talk about. And I brought this essay in by D.H. Lawrence, who's a writer I used to like tremendously. I don't so much like him anymore, but when I was young, I thought Lawrence was a wonderful writer, and he has an essay on New Mexico. Lawrence, this summer, Imtiaz went out west and was up in the Rockies all summer. And I think it was a wonderful experience for him. D.H. Lawrence came from a working class family in Wales, which is a coal mining part of England. And he was very poor when he grew up, had very few opportunities, and never got to college. He educated himself pretty much, and he worked as a high school teacher in an industrial part of Britain. And he had a really grimy, difficult life. And then he started writing these novels, and he got to travel, and at one point he went out to New Mexico. And he saw the Rockies and the Grand Canyon, and he went to, he lived north of Santa Fe. And Lawrence exploded when he saw this. It was so beautiful and so powerful and transformative, and he wrote this wonderful essay on New Mexico. And it starts out by saying, New Mexico was the greatest experience from the outside that I ever had in my life. So I thought, I will bring this in and share it with my students, and they will see instantly how wonderful a writer D.H. Lawrence is, and how beautiful it is to write this kind of prose, you know. So I brought it in, and I gave it to my students, and I signed it. And when they read it, they didn't like it very much, you know. And I took it personally, you know. I was really upset. And I said, well, what don't you like about it, right? And they started picking it apart, right? And it was just like, oh my God, my world is falling apart, you know. It became like a us against them situation, me against the rest of the students. You know, the more I tried to defend it, the more they started piling up on me, right? And I was just like in graduate school. This is my first year of graduate school or second year of graduate school. So I wasn't much older than my students. And I was having a hard time sort of like holding my own against these students. And it was so embarrassing and painful to have my beautiful essay that I worshipped torn to pieces, you know? So it's painful, you know, we grab these ideas because we're trying to live a richer life. And we clothe ourselves in them, but then, you know, somebody's trying to tear them off our back. And we have a strong inclination to respond with all kinds of violence and resentment, righteous violence and resentment, you know. So this is sort of an inevitable part of human life. And Mr. Harris's idea is to try to discredit these ideas that people hang on to. And I think that's a really bad idea. I really do. I think it's like, first of all, you know, he's like a fundamentalist himself, because he thinks everybody's rational. You know, I don't think people are basically rational beings. I don't think we believe the things we believe because they make rational sense. I really don't. I think we believe the things we believe because they resonate with us, on an emotional level. I was reading this article the other day about the unconscious mind, because the unconscious mind is so important in Zen. And this scientist was talking about how we catch a baseball. It's so interesting because he said, if you think about catching a baseball, you will drop the ball or you won't catch it. When somebody hits a baseball and it's going out into the outfield, you see these professional ball players and they just walk up and effortlessly catch the ball. And he said, how do they do it? The unconscious mind doesn't calculate anything. So you might think the unconscious mind is figuring out, first of all, but we don't consciously think this, but we don't think, okay, the ball's coming at this angle, blah, 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 I'll do this and this. You just walk toward the ball and you catch it. His first guess, this researcher's first guess was that we catch it by unconsciously calculating all the stuff, the speed of the ball and all this stuff. But he said, that's impossible. And indeed, the studies that he's done show we don't do that. So how do we catch a ball? What it turns out is that the unconscious mind tries to maintain a constant angle. See, as the ball is coming down, you walk forward, and what you're unconsciously trying to do is to keep the angle toward the ball the same, if that's making any sense. So the ball's above you, you're below the ball, there's a certain angle, right? And you just try to keep preserving that angle, and you keep walking forward, and you keep adjusting to hold that angle in place until you catch the ball. Now nobody knew this until this guy, in all of human history, nobody knew this until a guy did this research, because it's unconscious. And I thought it was just brilliant, So a lot of what we do is really unconscious, and we don't even know how we do it. But I think much of our life is like that. We believe things because they have an unconscious resonance, And I think it's quite naive to believe we're really rational beings. I think a small number of humans discipline their mind to be very rational. But most of our lives aren't rational, and most of the things we love have very little to do with reason. So for example, if you like to look at beautiful art at the art gallery, it's not a rational experience, but it might be the richest experience, one of the richest experiences you have. If you fall in love, it's not, I've been married for 30 years, I can tell you it's not a rational decision, And yet, really a wonderful thing. So I think we're capable of reason, but I think it's quite naive to imagine that we live our lives to be reasonable beings. So I think Harris is really doing a very inhumane thing to go around and try to tear other people's beliefs apart. It's not just unkind. I think it's counterproductive, But I think he has a point. And the point is, we do become prisoners of our ideas. And one way to think about Zen, I believe, is that Zen is about living. There's a way of living that's deeper or broader or bigger than ideas. And actually, it's quite possible not to really need ideas too much at all. To realize that ideas are like clothes. You can put them on or take them off. It's important to have the right clothes, right? If it's winter, you don't want to go out in a Hawaiian shirt. You need a sweater, But when you really, there are people who have never done any meditation who have this mindset too. Every once in a while you'll meet somebody who's tremendously sophisticated, I've known people in my life who started out as existentialists, then they became Marxists, then they became post-Marxists, then they became neo-pragmatists, then they became, post-structuralists. But at some point you realize, hey, this is not real. I just need them. You know, see? You can be a little looser about ideas when you've been this and you've been this, and you realize I've changed my opinion 50 million times. And if I continue to live, see, I'll continue to change. It's predictable. So then you don't take it so seriously. You know, if you're an 18-year-old and you think trees are alive and somebody starts tearing that apart, you get nervous, right? But if you're a 55-year-old and you've had a lot of your beliefs torn apart, including by yourself, you don't hold on so tightly, see? So I think even people who have never done any meditation can get into this way of experiencing life. But Zen is really all about a deeper life. You know, it's a life deeper than ideas. And many people think that's just not possible, but you know, it's definitely possible, right? Definitely possible. You know, we sit on the cushion, and when you sit down on the cushion, you know, all kinds of problems arise in your mind. And if you keep coming back to your breath, all kinds of worries, concerns, issues, you know, you just keep coming back to the moment, they begin to seem a little bit artificial, don't they? And at some point you realize that, you know, these are just these are not real. You know, these are not real. This what's happening right here and now, this is real. You know, and it's not really describable. You know, it's not really describable. If you say, well, this is a common experience for people who meditate. You know, you sit on the cushion, you watch your breath. You begin to be less haunted by your ideas and thoughts and emotions. You begin to be more serenely present in the moment, imperturbably present in the moment. And then, you know, you hear a bird or something. And for just a minute, it's like you could say you become the bird. You know, to say that doesn't quite capture the experience either, does it? My teacher, Genki Roshi, was a very young monk. Unlike many people in Japan, he became a monk when he was really a teenager. So the poor guy had to do sesshin when he was like 13 or 14 years old. I think he might have even been 12. And that's very difficult. He was an adopted child of a very famous Zen master named Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. And Yamamoto Genpo Roshi was, by all accounts, a very kind man. But he was a celibate monk who had no idea what it was like to raise children. And he had took Genki in as a little boy. And I think when Genki was about 12, Yamamoto Genpo said, "Okay, well, you're ready for sesshin," you know. So this poor kid had to sit there, and he said, you know, he would just sit there, his legs would hurt so much, and he said he would just sit there and pray for an earthquake. Yeah, he said, "I'd sit there and I'd think, let an earthquake just pull the temple down on my head and kill me, you know." And maybe he thought, and kill Genpo Roshi too, you know, while you're at it. Anyway, he was in agony. And he said the first real breakthrough experience he ever had was he got up at the break period and he went into the bathroom of the temple, the outhouse. And in the outhouse of a Zen temple in Japan, this particular one, Ryotakuji, there was an altar next to the place where you pee-pee and so on. And on the altar there was a Buddhist statue and candle and flowers, fresh flowers. And Genki Roshi said, you know, he was trudging into the bathroom taking a pee, and he was so miserable and unhappy and just wished he were dead. And then he looked over at these flowers and he said the tears were just running off his face. You know, you could say, you know, he said, "I became the flowers," you know. Well, you know, actually, Became the Flowers doesn't quite get it either. You know, it doesn't quite describe it. Ultimately, the reality is not describable. You know, the experience is so much richer than the concept. You know, these words, these concepts are just crude generalizations, you know. I mean, the thing about words is we can't keep reinventing new words. So we can't have a word for was in the outhouse, saw the flowers, tears running down face, you know, no pain. There's no word for that, right? So we say became one, I became the flowers. So, that's really not quite it. So, the more you zazen you do, the more you sit, the more you realize that these words and ideas and concepts are not terrifically accurate, you know? And I think that gives you a great compassion, you know, because you realize, you know, we can call it enlightened mind. We can call it Dharmakaya. We can call it God. We can call it Allah. We can call it the stimulation of the cortex, you know, the frontal cortex. We can call it gamma wave synchrony, you know. We can call it deconstructing culture, whatever. But those are very arbitrary, right? So, we need ideas, and if you do zazen long enough, you realize they're not real. But you need them like you need clothes, right? You know, you just need some. Don't take them too seriously. Don't get upset. You know, don't be too attached to ideas. They're not real, and it's really a great pity, I think. The people can't experience the kind of wordless presence that we experience in sitting. I wish more people could experience that. I really do think it would have a positive effect on humans. And I think we'd be more flexible and open and also much more compassionate, you know. Because, you know, mostly people are afraid when you get into these insane debates and these absurd attacks, you know, these ridiculous, vicious attacks, you know, it reaches a point of it's ridiculous, it's absurd, it's pathetic, and nobody's made better by this, you know, I think. At any rate, you know, living beyond ideas is really a wonderful thing, and probably when you came here today, you had a little taste of that, right? I mean, maybe not this morning, but if you have been doing zazen, I'm sure you had these moments where the pure presence of sheer being is so wonderful, and there's nothing to it. You know, there's just nothing to it except pure presence, sheer presence, and it's absolutely wonderful, absolutely sacred, holy, marvelous, interesting, whatever you want to call it. So, it's a different way of life, and I just think it's indescribably wonderful. So don't be afraid, you know. Don't be afraid of, no matter what happens. You know, don't be afraid, right? It's like a moment always comes back. It's always got a perfection beyond words. You know, many things we believe may be taken away from us, you know. And when they're taken away, you know, it's just like koan practice. You know, you sit there and you think, oh, this is so painful. I love this idea. I held on to this idea has been my salvation, right? But really, no idea is your salvation. That's not true. This moment is your salvation, you know. But people think, you know, this idea is so important, you know. If you take it away from me, I'll have nothing. And so, you know, I'll have to kill you, you know, that sort of thing. But actually, you know, all ideas have like a natural life. I really believe this. All ideas you know, they come into existence, they're compelling for a while, and then they're absurd, and then they're gone, you know? This is like, really. People worry about, you read these, like Hitchens' book is this attack on the existence of God. First of all, how ridiculous. It's ridiculous, right? No arguments are going to be compelling, really. And even if they're devastating, what if there is no God? It's only a fear that makes us think that if there is no quote-unquote God, we've lost something, right? Because the moment's just as wonderful as ever, what if it turns out, someday scholars do a study, or archaeologists are doing a dig, and they're in India, and they come up with a book that says, actually the Buddha never lived. This is all just an invention. There was a writer in the 5th century who created a character named the Buddha. Right? And you can think, oh my God, all my life has been a sham. This is terrible. And you have to argue against it, right? All these guys, I have to disprove this. This must be some problem here. We can pick this apart. It's like, don't bother. The evidence of this path, what makes this path good, worthy, alive, whatever, is what happens to you on the cushion. Buddha is just an idea. Buddhist is just a name. I'm not a Buddhist. When people ask me, are you a Buddhist? I say, oh yes, absolutely. I don't want them to think I'm a Republican, for example. But my true nature has no name, has no name, no form, and form arises out of it, So, really the clouds are not Buddhist, trees are not Buddhist, they're not Christian, they're not Jewish. They're not atheists, trees are not atheists either, A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words. The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, the world-honored one, with his great compassion, has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way. And after making bows, he took his leave. And then Ananda said to the Buddha, what did he realize to admire you so much? The world-honored one replied, a fine horse runs even at the shadow of the whip. I have to say, I've always hated that line, you have to understand that the Buddha was trained to be a military leader. See, he was trained to be a king or a chieftain, really tribal chieftain. And he was taught archery, horsemanship, sword fighting, the works, right? And sometimes he would use terminology or metaphors or analogies from his training. So the Buddha is a horseman, right? He rides a horse, rode a horse, expert horseman. So if you ride a horse, it's not like a bullwhip, it's like a riding crop. Maybe this should be translated as like riding crop. Some horses need to see the riding crop. Some horses need to feel the riding crop. So what the Buddha says here is, some horses just have to see the shadow of the riding crop on the ground and they start running well. So what he's really saying is, ideas are not real. They're like shadows on the ground. See, some horses know this. You don't need to touch them with the riding crop. They see the shadow on the ground and they run. They know it's time to run. See, so this is a horse who's free from holding too tight to his ideas. On the edge of a sword, over the ridge of an iceberg, with no steps, no ladders, climbing the cliffs without hands. See, we don't need ideas. But we need them, but we don't need them, right? They're just ideas. They're like clothes. We can put them on and we can take them off. If you can live that way, you're really free, right? Really free. And in one way of putting it is to say that that's what this path is all about. It's like post, if you practice the path, you're the way, you're like a post-cultural person. Really, this is like being a post-cultural person. Yes, you have a culture, et cetera, but in this moment, there is no culture. Really and truly, hard to believe, but just keep sitting, okay?